Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello everybody, I'm just taking a quick break from researching and writing the next episode in the life of John Marshall to record this quick introduction to a special crossover podcast extravaganza between American Biography and the History of the Papacy podcast. The impetus of this special was the recent papal visit by Pope Francis to the United States, which got me looking into the history of the diplomatic relations between the United States and the Holy See. I found it was pretty interesting, and I mentioned it to Steve Guerra, who hosts the History of the Papacy podcast, and he thought it was interesting too. Then, on top of that, I found out that one of my old friends from college, and one of the groomsmen at my wedding, who works as a reporter, covered a leg of Pope Francis' visit and was on hand when he held a mass in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And voila, this special was born. I hope you like it. Hello, and welcome to Pope and Fresh, a special crossover podcast featuring the History of the Papacy and American Biography podcast. Today we're going to be talking about Pope Francis's recent visit to the United States. I'm Tom Daly, creator and host of American Biography, and my co-host for today is the History of the Papacy's Steve Guerra. Say hello, Steve.
Hi, thanks for putting this all together, Tom.
Oh, I'm super, super excited about it. Really glad to have been handed this opportunity to be able to work with them. How was I ever really going to connect our show to yours? I didn't know how, but Pope Francis went ahead and cleared that issue up for us and gave us this opportunity. So thank you, Pope Frank.
Yes.
Before we get started, we thought it might be interesting to give a little background about the history of the diplomatic relations between the United States and the Holy See. For those not familiar, the Holy See both refers to an ecclesiastical jurisdiction as well as a diplomatic entity encompassing the Catholic Church and the papacy, with its headquarters in Vatican City, but extended to the Pope's other temporal home, otherwise known as the Papal States, over which he is the sovereign, an area at one time which encompassed most of Italy. The United States first established consular relations with the Holy See as early as 1797. However, this does not denote official diplomatic relations. Rather, the classification refers to commercial relations protected by commercial agents called consuls, and it wasn't until 1848 that official diplomatic relations were established, and even then it was not on an ambassadorial level. President Polk appointed and the Senate confirmed a charge d'affaires to represent the United States at the Vatican. This lower diplomatic designation was because there was a worry that a full diplomatic mission might in some way be a violation of the Constitution's establishment. Nevertheless, this would be the status quo until 1868, when Congress did an about-face and refused to appropriate funds for the embassy in Rome in response to mounting anti-Catholic sentiment in the United States. This was the result of a dramatic increase in the rate of immigration to the United States in these years, with the majority of the newcomers hailing from Ireland, France, Italy, and Spain, all Catholic nations, which helped produce a level of nativist pushback. The lack of official communication was reinforced when just 2 years later, the Kingdom of Italy conquered Rome in 1870, eliminating the Papal States, and creating a cloud of confusion around the nature of the papacy's existence that the Italians themselves didn't figure out until the 1929 Lateran Treaty, which created an independent Vatican City. Despite the lack of official diplomatic relations, Woodrow Wilson, who was the first sitting president to travel abroad during his term of office, also became the first president to visit the Vatican when he met Benedict XV there in 1919.
And that would pretty much be it until 1939, when FDR appointed a personal representative to meet with Pius VII, though it was stressed that this representative was being sent to the Pope and not to the Holy See. However, what the difference is practically speaking is negligible. In 1951, Truman tried to formalize relations and nominated a full ambassador to represent the United States at the Vatican. However, the Senate took no action and Truman withdrew the nomination. Neither Eisenhower nor Kennedy utilized personal representatives to the Vatican, nor did they attempt to resume relations. But relations turned a corner in 1959 when Eisenhower visited the Vatican himself, and since, each succeeding president has continued the practice. During Johnson's presidency, Paul VI became the first pontiff to visit the United States, which doubled as the first papal visit to the United Nations in 1965. The biggest boon to relations came following the 1984 Concordat between Italy and Pope John Paul II, which the U.S. State Department decided brought sufficient clarity to the nature of the Holy See, and the Senate confirmed the ambassador to the Vatican. I think it bears mentioning that John Paul II and Reagan were already Cold War allies by the time this occurred, and resumption of diplomatic relations at this moment smacks of good old-fashioned realpolitik. John Paul II's papacy bestrode the resumption of relationships, and it was during his tenure in St. Peter's chair that bilateral relations really took off. John Paul II visited the United States 7 times during his reign and met multiple times with 4 U.S. presidents: Carter, Reagan, Clinton, and George W. Bush. With his recent trip to the United States, Francis was the 4th pope to meet with the U.S. president during a visit to the United States, as well as the 4th time a pope addressed the United Nations. And Francis was the 3rd pontiff received at the White House. But, despite not containing any historical firsts, Francis's recent visit certainly had a fresh new feel to it. So for more about this, we'd like to turn things over to Steve Sterling to talk a little bit about what he witnessed while covering the pontiff's visit.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, so joining us for today's discussion is Steve Sterling. He's a real-life professional journalist who reported on the Philadelphia leg of the pontiff's recent visit for the Star-Ledger newspaper out of New Jersey. Steve, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we are absolutely thrilled to have you. So you saw the Pope. You were there. You witnessed it. The throngs, his triumphal procession, if you will.
I did.
Jersey, you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So I was in Philadelphia for the Papal Mass on the it was the last major event that he held in the city. So it was you know, most of my experience was kind of caught up in getting to and from there, which was kind of funny. There was a lot of security for this event. Secret Service was running it, I had to go through multiple security checkpoints. They had to screen my entire background. I had to give the Vatican my social security number and, you know, all of my social media accounts to make sure that I hadn't said anything, you know, in poor taste about Pope Francis in the past. So after months of screening, I was eventually cleared, and they gave me press credentials for the event, which I had. So I made my way to Philadelphia, and it was sort of a surreal experience, to say the least, because, you know, they had cleared out most of downtown Philadelphia. There was no traffic going through the area, so it was sort of like this weird, you know, sort of dystopian city with like pockets of people moving around. Because when I arrived, I wasn't anywhere near where any of the papal activity was at that point. But you know, once there, you had to go through another series of security screenings to get to, you know, where you might have a chance to see the Pope. And I got there on the Saturday, out ahead of it. So at that point, I believe he was at the seminary at the time, but I had to cross sort of the papal path in order to get to the house I was staying at. And it so happened that he was doing a parade nearby, and so I had to wait, and he did stream past me once. But you know, that was sort of all of my experience for the first day. But the Papal Mass the next day was certainly, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to get an experience like that again. It was a pleasure to report on, because it was just the magnitude of it was so massive. You know, I'm not sure if they ever put a total figure on it, but I believe they thought it was close to 1 million people were there for that. You know, it was just a sea of people. And the thing that struck me most in talking to some of those people was just, you know, how well behaved and, you know, just overall grateful they were to be there. You know, there's something, you know, I've covered, you know, religious events in the past, and, you know, certainly Christian and or Catholic events in the past, but there seems to be there's a different feeling that seemed to revolve around Pope Francis that, you know, was sort of echoed in everybody that I spoke to there, which was sort of fascinating to me.
Yeah. You know, that's sort of what the feeling behind putting this show together was. That's why we called it Pope and Fresh. I mean, there's something so different about people's reactions to this pontiff, it feels like to me. You know, obviously we were, I believe, in college still. No, we weren't. When Benedict visited, it was in 2008, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I believe. And it was just an all-around different feeling.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, you know, I had started my professional career by that point. But even, you know, there was never any of the same feelings surrounding, you know, Pope Benedict and any of my dealings as a reporter. This was certainly different. We talked to a number of people that actually said that they came out to Philadelphia because, you know, Pope Francis had reinvigorated their faith, and that, you know, they had been sort of, you know, one foot in and one foot out Catholics, and they were sort of indifferent to the whole thing after, you know, what was several years of, you know, scandal, essentially, for the church. I mean, that's the headline that they had for them. And, you know, this sort of reinvigorated their faith and, you know, reminded them of, you know, why they had taken up Catholicism in the first place.
The people that you met along the way, would you say they were on the younger end, the older end?
It was really diverse. I mean, there was, you know, not only like in term, and that goes across all spectrums, whether it be racially, you know, culturally, age wise. I mean, there were a lot of larger groups that had a lot of young people in them. Of course, I mean, you had the Pope baby. There were several of the Pope babies that were there. But, you know, it did cut across, you know, you know, sort of all socioeconomic boundaries. I mean, my favorite image of the entire thing was probably some nuns playing football with some Philadelphia Eagles fans, which was, you know, one of those things I don't anticipate I'll see anytime soon. But it was a really good cross section. That was, you know, that was one of the other things that struck me about the crowd there. Yeah.
Well, I think Francis probably would be really, really grateful to hear that. I'm sure he seems to see himself as a consensus builder. I think he might, Steve Guerra, you might have more of an insight into this, but he does seem to have kind of a mission of renewal about him.
That was one thing I was wondering that kind of ties into that is, would you say, I mean, I would imagine most of the people were Catholics, but were there other people who weren't Catholics who are still interested in seeing what was going on?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we talked to a couple of people through the course of the event that, you know, said, you know, they weren't even Catholic. There was just something so moving about him and, you know, what he has brought to the papacy, so that they came out just to be a part of that experience. And, you know, a lot of those people who were outside of the faith that, we talked to, you know, said it was a truly moving experience, you know, even though, it isn't, you know, a part of their chosen faith's, you know, hierarchy.
I mean, I myself can sort of attest to that. I'm fascinated by Pope Francis. You know, I myself am a non-believer, but yet I find him incredibly enigmatic and magnetic. You know, so I can sort of testify to how some of the people who are coming out to see him just out of the sheer curiosity, you know, may be feeling.
I just had a couple of questions, talk about the mass in the was it in the Eagles Stadium or the Phillies?
Neither, actually. It was in front of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. So it was outdoors. The Benjamin Franklin Parkway runs sort of for a long stretch directly in front of that. So essentially they had people lined up going straight down the Benjamin Franklin Parkway, like into the heart of the city. And the Pope was on a stage out in front of the art museum.
Did he run up the steps like Rocky or?
No. Unfortunately, we did not get that that joy.
So, like, where were you sitting in relation? Because the Benjamin Franklin, it starts like right on the border, kind of. Well, it's all in Center City, but the bench mm-hmm. and so it starts, and people were like, it was seating all the way, or was it crowd?
Oh, it's all standing room only. But. For the most part, I was actually seated. So, you know, in the setup that they had, the stage was sort of placed, you know, more or less directly in front of the stairs of the museum. It was a massive stage. And directly in front of that, they had probably a couple of thousand seats. And then they had press risers, which were, you know, basically, you know, bleachers going up with a, you know, a slot down the middle that could allow the crowd to see in. And they had video screens and stuff like that everywhere. So I was seated in one of the press risers. So, you know, it would be, I guess if you were thinking about it in terms of a stadium or something like that, I'd be in the front of the lower bowl.
Did you get a feeling of actually being in church, or was it a whole different experience?
There were points. I mean, it was certainly unique, you know, but, you know, one of the most powerful things to me just about the experience in general were sort of church-like. You know, I was blown away at the points of meditation during the sermon. It was jarring how quiet nearly a million people could be. And there was so much reverence given to that, to the people that were there, that you could hear, you know, at points like that, I'd go out and I'd sort of watch the crowd, you know, behind me. And, you know, you could hear sounds from like a passing, you know, police motorcycle or something like that. It just went dead silent. And then, you know, when they delivered communion, that was incredible. And it felt it felt like being in church, but it was like no church that I've ever been in. You know, they had, I think it was more than 1500 volunteer priests, go out, and each of them, were sort of under a golden and ivory umbrella. and they sort of walked down the Benjamin Franklin Parkway because the portion of the roadway was actually open to allow the Pope to come to and from and to allow emergency vehicles and stuff like that. So they walked down in pairs, you know, these just this stream of these golden umbrellas to hand out communion to the entire crowd, which was certainly super powerful, and it had that, you know, church-like religious feel to it. It's just, you know, it wasn't your average Sunday.
I'd say not. That sounds like quite a day.
Mm-hmm. Steve, when you were talking to people, it seemed like when I was reading in the newspaper or reading like online, and I have some friends in Philadelphia, that they were kind of mad that like everything was so shut down. Did you get any like negative feelings from people that, you know, the city was on such lockdown?
Well, you know, I think there's a difference in how people that came there viewed that and how people that lived there viewed that. You know, I have a lot of friends that live in Philadelphia. Most, and I wanted to in going, I was like, oh, I'm going to be down in Philadelphia for a few days. I'll meet up with some people. Everybody left. It was like nobody wanted any, who was from Philadelphia that I know wanted any part of that. So unless they were, I mean, I think people were a little annoyed by that, if they weren't participating in the festivities, it was probably more of a hindrance than anything else. But from the people that actually, from the pilgrims themselves, you know, I didn't get a sense of that. I mean, and if you were part of it, you know, security aside, and things, you know, given the magnitude of the event, they probably went as smoothly as they could. You know, I think they had planned for a lot more people than actually came. I think they were planning for upwards of 2 million people, and it ended up short of 1 million. So, you know, it you know, there was such a uniqueness to the experience. I mean, because, you know, once you were through security, you were literally walking down the center of some of the largest, you know, some of the most major intersections in the city of Philadelphia unencumbered. And, you know, there was just sort of a unique feel around that I think, you know, people seemed to enjoy. So, I didn't get much of a sense from the people that were there. That they were annoyed by the shutdown, but I cannot speak for the people who live there and perhaps fled the city because it was a massive operation.
Did like were shops open? Could you get a Tony Luke sandwich or
it was sort of hit or miss in that front. And you know, when we went out to eat, you know, there was a sense of, you know, a sort of a letdown, I guess, because if you were on the periphery of the Pope zone, you know. It would often take, you know, think just short of an act of God to get people to go to your restaurant because they'd have to go through so much security. If it wasn't on their way, then, you know, a lot of restaurants and shops, you know, lost basically all of their foot traffic. And then it was, you know, in the zone itself, I mean, it was sort of, you know, hit or miss. I mean, you had there was some price gouging that went on the first day. I believe, and Dunkin' Donuts and a couple of other vendors jacked up their prices. And then when they were called out for it, everybody was giving out free coffee, or coffee for a dollar or something like that. But, you know,
papal price gouging.
Yeah. But, you know, overall, you know, it was sort of hit or miss in terms of shops and restaurants and stuff like that.
So while Francis's visit seems like it's been very successful overall, it has not been without some. It seems that unlike previous visits, where the pontiff has seemingly been more in line with cultural conservatives, and this trip, it's the American left that's really embracing him, where there's almost an uncharacteristic pushback by conservative leaders in the United States against some of the things that Francis is choosing to highlight. Was there any feel, Steve, did you get any feel for that in Philadelphia?
You know, I didn't. It might have been, you know, a consequence of, you know, what I was covering. But, you know, there didn't seem like politics wasn't one of the, you know, the sort of the issues that I came across while I was there, which I thought was interesting because, you know, he is, you know, a very different Pope than his predecessors, based on, you know, some of the opinions that he's had and he's put out there. But, you know, it wasn't anything that I really encountered during my trip there. And, you know, it's which was, you know, given the political climate of today, which was a little surprising to me.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's refreshing that that type of interaction could still happen in the United States when it feels like it may never be able to at times. Mm-hmm. And that certainly is different from the perception coming from his visit to Washington, which was much more overtly.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely something that stood out to me just, you know, for a lot of the reasons that you just mentioned. I mean, I was sort of, it's sort of strange that it's an awkward experience to run across so many people that are unilaterally grateful for an experience and friendly. I mean, people were thanking all of the city workers that they saw. You know, a couple of our photographers got thanked for taking pictures, and, you know, there was no sense of animosity at all or, polarization or anything like that, which is, you know, sort of a, you know, it's a weird thing to say, but it was a bizarre experience, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Bizarre, but refreshing.
Yes.
But some people haven't been quite so calm and reflective. Fox News, for instance, has been a vocal critic of the positions that Francis has, you know, taken on things like global climate change, income inequality, and several other, you know, poignant topics in the United States today. To be the one to answer this question, kind of opening it up to the floor for sort of a group discussion here. What do we think about this? This is a new strange alignment in the United States. The liberal Pope is something that, you know, hasn't been experienced since the 1960s. Steve Guerra?
I think it's kind of strange that, the conservative and progressive kind of get all mixed up together because, he could be sort liberal on some political issues, but he seems fairly conservative as far as the religious issues go. He hasn't really said anything about the ordination of women, and I think he may have said that he was against it. Liturgically, he seems fairly conservative. I've seen kind of mixed reviews on that, but he hasn't budged on abortion, and he's shown that he's leans a little bit not traditional on the marriage about divorce and that sort of thing. But that seemed like something that was coming down the pipe anyways. So I think he's kind of a tough guy to wrap your mind around.
Yeah, it seems like people don't want to see him as a gray character. It's very much a, you know, you're with us on our side or you're against us on our side. You know, it seems like more liberal America is just going crazy for the fact that he's talking about poverty, the environment, and completely ignoring and turning a blind eye to the fact that a lot of the positions that he holds are still very socially conservative. And vice versa, the conservatives are very upset about some of the positions he's taking on climate control, climate change and poverty, but completely ignoring the fact that he's still in line with them on issues near and dear to them.
I think that it's really made me think a lot that the things that you'd think that the left-wing blogosphere would just blow their stacks about, they've been pretty quiet about. And the conservatives, for the most part, were pretty quiet about it. I wonder if it is, the religious experience has transcended the political to some degree.
Well, I mean, I think that's what the Pope would want above all else. But he's, at the same time,
encyclicals.
He's taken a pretty hardline stance in his encyclical effects. He's even talking about the carbon cycle, climate change, the implications being that it is man-made, you know, things that are pretty dogmatically opposite from his traditional base in the United States, which is the conservative.
And there seems to be a lot of interesting with his said ecumenical as well, with his relations with other churches. It's really thrown a monkey wrench in a lot of the different relationships. Like, he's really tight with the Patriarch of Constantinople. He's a big environmentalist activist too, and but like other Orthodox patriarchs have kind of kept Francis at arm's length. And I think similar with the Anglicans and some of the Protestants, Francis has shown an ability to get close with them, but they don't want to get too close with them. So that's another dimension to that he's rattling a lot of cages.
that idea of reaching out across faiths is, and while I have a papal specialist, you know, with me here,
don't go too far.
What are there any realistic expectations of, you know, that great schism ever closing?
I think there probably is, not in our lifetimes, because I just don't think that those things move that fast. But there's some serious divides that between, say, the Catholics and the Protestants, and the Catholics and the Orthodox, you know, that's including like all of them, the Copts, et cetera. There's some pretty big gaps in there that I think if you were getting to the point where you wanted to, that you're going to say that they're going to be in full communion, that would take a long, long time to iron out. There's real, you know, there's a political element to it that's, you know, 1,000 years old, but there's also some serious dogmatic issues, especially that have cropped up since Vatican I, that would be difficult to iron out anytime soon.
But at least the process has started. And I mean, I don't know if that's really an end goal for anybody. Doesn't, you know, affect me in any way whatsoever. But is that something that is the idea of a one universal church something that believers are invested in anymore?
I mean, I think they're invested in it. All of them, I would say, are invested in it in theory. And I think now with everything that's going on in the Middle East, and you have, you know, like the Syrians are in big trouble, you know, they're, you know, a lot of Christian groups are getting, almost getting eradicated by ISIS. I think there's a bigger push to have closer relationships so that everybody isn't cutting each other out in the knees to actually help people. And maybe that's something that Francis is bringing about, is that, you know, the people are actually getting harmed over there, and, you know, and in Africa and other places. So why are we, you know, why are Christians attacking each other when they really should be helping people who are in harm's way? So there's a theoretical and a practical purpose for some sort of unity.
I've heard it said that the Pope's mission was to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And he has put a pretty sharp critique forward against the morality of the marketplace, and for putting humans in service of the economy as opposed to the economy in the service of, if that makes. Now, the Catholic Church obviously is taking a position on poverty that you could say is really as old as the institution itself. And Jesus in the scriptures certainly took a fairly anti-wealth stance. So you could say that this is more of an originalist position that Francis is taking on the issue. But it's certainly bringing him into sharp political conflicts within the United States, and particularly with his traditional base. Is there a danger that the Pope runs in doing things like this? Does he come close to losing legitimacy? Putting that out there for anybody.
I think the biggest thing that that he has to worry about, and that the thing that comes up with pretty clearly to me, is, you know, like the Vatican, I mean, it's just practically dripping with gold. And I think he has to show in some way that he's putting his money where his mouth is.
He got rid of the big crown, though, didn't he? Isn't that one of his first things? The triple level crown, didn't he?
I don't think, I think
Gucci shoes are gone.
The guy before John Paul II, his name escapes me. I think it was Paul something as well. He stopped using the crown, and Francis doesn't wear the fancy shoes like Benedict did. I don't even think Benedict's shoes were like a name brand. They were handmade for him. But I think he's shown some of those things. But that's almost a throwaway. Yeah, they're, you know, he's not buying $2,000 shoes. But what if, you know, what's he doing when there's practical things? I mean, you know, that there's paintings in the Vatican that are probably would sell on the open market for millions of dollars. You know, that's when I visited the Vatican a couple of years ago, that was the first thing that hit me after going through like 2 miles of museum. It's like, wow, there's a lot of wealth here, like a ridiculous amount of wealth.
So you think that sort of hypocrisy?
I don't know if hypocrisy is too far, you know, if that's maybe too far, but I think it's something that a lot of people are going to say. I don't know. I wouldn't necessarily say it because that is a cultural and that a cultural legacy and that has value. But I think that that's something that's out there is that the Catholic Church has a lot of money that they're not necessarily spending it as well as they could be.
I mean, I think that's a solid point. I think hypocrisy, as you say, might not be the right word, but it certainly has that sort of, oh, come on, are you aware of what you're talking about quality about it? Similar to as when a church where individuals don't marry starts talking about, you know, marriage issues. I think they kind of run the same risk. And I do think when they start weighing in on these things where they don't necessarily appear to have real knowledge about, they do run the risk, particularly in the United States, which is not overwhelmingly Catholic, of losing that moral voice.
That was one of the things that I did notice regarding the papal visit, while I was in Philadelphia, is, you know, there was a big, you know, him meeting with the victims of sexual abuse. While it is an example of saying the right things, the instant reaction that I did see come across from a lot of groups is, you know, sitting down and talking to people for 20 minutes doesn't really do anything. Is, you know, you have to do a little bit more than just saying the right thing. So I think there is some of that there, and it is an issue they could potentially face, where it's all well and good to sort of reinvigorate the image of the papacy and to reinvigorate, you know, and to provide a fresh face. You know, how far does that go?
That's a good point, because speaking to the abuse scandal, as far as I know, Cardinal Law still has a cushy position in the Vatican. He was the cardinal in Boston during when that Boston sex abuse scandal broke. Basically, John Paul II took him into the Vatican, where he's been living comfortably since, after basically covering up for a number of years. So, yeah, if you have this face, how far does that go?
Yeah, that's going to be the telling point to see how... you know, does the bloom come off the rose after he's had to really deal with these hard issues? I mean, it's happened many times with other political figures that, you know, they come in strong, but then get worn down.
Well, he himself has predicted that his papacy isn't going to be a pretty long one. And I think that's, you know, nothing against him personally. I think he recognizes, like everyone else, that he's a man in his late 70s, and that, you know, Father Time is undefeated. So it might be that ultimately, despite the enthusiasm that he generates, he might not end up leaving the type of strong legacy that we might think he might today, because he might in the end just be a transitional figure.
And it could be his legacy that if he does, with between him and Benedict, set a precedent that you don't hang on until the end, leaving, you know, strong, instead of having things string out like they did with John Paul II, which that didn't seem like it was a very healthy situation.
No, I agree. I think talking about Benedict, I think that might be the highlight of his papacy, was not serving until he couldn't serve anymore.
Mm-hmm. Because he seemed to be the real placeholder to me, that after somebody like John Paul II, you couldn't come in with somebody strong. And that seems to be a thing that's happened a lot in papal history, is having a placeholder to fill the gap before, you know, the things are, the, you know, the organization's ready to move on again and pick what direction it's going on.
Now, do you think there's anything to him being a pontiff that was from the New World that makes his papacy different?
Did that seem like a big deal to you guys? I don't know how I felt about that. That he wasn't from old Europe.
I mean, I think it's, you know, a big deal in that, you know, it's giving representation to an area that isn't, you know, the old stronghold of the Catholic Church, in areas where they've seen a lot of growth in recent history. I mean, that's certainly not Europe, and that's certainly not the United States or any, you know. So, you know, I do think that there is some amount of impact there. I mean, you know, going with somebody from, you know, a Hispanic speaking or a Hispanic Pope is sort of probably energizing a base that's been growing for a long time. And shows, you know, for once that the church is sort of willing to look outside the box. So I think there's something, I don't know how significant it is, but I think that there's something to that, at least symbolically.
I read this interesting thing that there's a lot of Italians who are upset because the Pope is obviously a worldwide figure, but he's also their local bishop. And they feel that in America, bishops are almost always chosen, you know, from the United States, and bishops in Canada are chosen from Canada, and almost, you know, even their locality, and they're feeling like they're kind of cut out of the whole thing, that their bishop is being selected from anybody from around the world. So they're losing a voice in their own locality. So there's a local issue as compared. I mean, it's a very unique position the Pope holds, that he does have a specific job based in a location, the city of Rome and the surrounding area, but then he's also a worldwide figure.
That's something I never once considered. That's a really interesting point.
But they get the Pope. Come
yeah,
on.
Yeah, I mean right? You got to give and take a little.
Yeah, your bishop is one of the three biggest individuals in the world. I think that's a good trade-off.
But it is causing some sort of rift there that maybe, and it's something that Francis has talked about, of to some degree devolving power to bishops and giving them more power, and that's kind of, that's part of his ecumenical relations too. I think he called himself he didn't call himself like one of the fancier titles. He called himself just the Bishop of Rome or something when he was with one of the other major bishops, or he called himself the Patriarch of Rome, which is something that popes haven't really, that hasn't been the title that they've touted in a long time. So, I mean, you could say that it's his humility, but he's also, that could be a major reorganization he's going for.
Wow. I dusting off that old chestnut.
Yeah.
Patriarch of Rome.
Or Patriarch of the West, rather.
Patriarch of the West.
Which is, yeah. I mean, that is an oldie.
I've never even heard of it, to be honest. Stephen Sterling.
Yeah.
In just a few words, what was your biggest takeaway from Pope Francis?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not a terribly religious person myself. So, I mean, it was sort of refreshing, I guess. I mean, that was the you know, if I could encompass everything, it was that it was a refreshing experience, because I've been to a lot of religious events in my career, in my lifetime, and nothing Christian or Catholic that I've ever been to has had that kind of, good feeling around it, I guess, or invigorating feeling around it. You know, it's always been sort of dry. So I was sort of captivated by that fact, I guess, more than anything else.
That's wonderful. Steve, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
It was really great to have the insight that you were able to bring into this visit. Do you have any plugs?
You can follow me on Twitter at S Sterling, S-S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G.
If you're from New Jersey or the Tri-State area,
yes,
Weather Guy.
Yeah, you can find me. I'm New Jersey Weather Guy. If you search that on Facebook, and you can also find my work on NJ.com or in the Star Ledger.
Fantastic. Well, Steve, thank you again, and have a great day. Well, that's it. I hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you check out Steve Guerra and the History of the Papacy podcast, available on iTunes and wherever fine podcasts are to be found. And you can find me in all the usual places. You can like American Biography on Facebook, follow me on Twitter at American_bio, check out the website, AmericanBiography.webs.com, or just shoot me an email at AmericanBiographyPodcast@gmail.com. Well, I'm going to get back to working on the life of John Marshall now, and I hope to talk to you all real soon. Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.